cash than I would normally have. I increased the real estate in Vietnam, and I increased the equity portfolio in Vietnam. Tony: So what might that look like today then, percentage-wise, out of curiosity? Mark: Well, I mean, it's difficult to tell because it's so big. Tony: Are you talking about portfolio or something else? Mark: No, the thing is this. I don't know. I mean, I'm not counting everything every day. Tony: Well, what would it look like roughly? Mark: Roughly, I think bonds and cash would be now something like 30%, 35%, and then stocks maybe 20%, then real estate, I don't know, 30%, and gold 25%. It's more than 100%, but who cares? I'm the U.S. Treasury. Tony: We know why you like cash. What about bonds, when many people are afraid they're at the lowest level they can be? Mark: The bonds I traditionally hold are emerging market bonds. The corporate bonds are also mostly in dollars and euros. But I want to explain this very clearly. These emerging market bonds have a very high equity character. If the stock markets go down, the value of these bonds also declines. Like in 2008, they tumbled like junk bonds. So they're more like equities than treasuries. I own some of these. That's why when I say I have a low equity exposure of 20%, my equity exposure through these bonds is probably more than 20%, maybe 30%. I think sometimes as an investor, we make a mistake that we have too much confidence in our view because my view is irrelevant for the whole marketplace. Do you understand? The market will move independently of my view, so I may not be optimistic about treasuries, but I could see a condition under which treasuries would actually be quite a good investment, even for a few years. You will only earn your 2.5% or 3%, but that may be a higher return in a world where asset prices go down. Do you understand? If the stock market goes down for the next 3 years by, say, 5% per annum or 10% per annum, and you have this yield of 2.5% to 3%, then you'll be the king. Tony: What about other asset classes? Mark: There's a lot of speculation for high-end real estate. High-end real estate is at the incredibly inflated level. I believe all these inflated levels, I'm not saying they can't go any higher, but I am suggesting that one day they'll come down meaningfully. And that in that condition, you want to have something that is a hedge. Tony: You have a quarter of your assets in gold. Why? Mark: Actually, what is interesting is when I told this to audiences before 2011, when prices started dropping, people said, Mark, if you're so positive about gold, why would you only have 25% of your money in gold? I said, well, maybe I'm wrong, and I want to be diversified because the gold price has already had a big move and is due for consolidation. Gold is probably to some extent a hedge, but not a perfect hedge in an asset deflation scenario if you have it in physical form. But it's probably a better investment than a lot of other illiquid assets. It will probably also go down in price, but less than other stuff. Treasury bonds for a few years at least should do okay in a deflation scenario for asset prices, at least until the government goes bankrupt. Tony: Last question. If you couldn't pass on money to your kids, only a set of principles to build a portfolio, what would they be? Mark: I think the most important lesson I would give a child or anyone is, it's not important what you buy, it's the price at which you pay for something. You have to be careful about buying things at a high price, because then they drop and you're discouraged. You have to keep cool and have money when your neighbors and everybody else is depressed. You don't want to have money when everybody else has money, because then everybody else also competes for assets and they are expensive. I would also say I personally think we have in general no clue of what will happen in 5 or 10 minutes' time, let alone a year's time or 10 years' time. We can make certain assumptions and sometimes they look fine and sometimes they're bad and so forth, but we really don't know for sure. That's why as an investor I would say you should be diversified. Now, not every investor can do that because some investors, they invest in their own business. If I have a business like I'm Bill Gates, then I put all my money in Microsoft. And that was, for a while at least, a very good investment. Probably for most people, the best is to have their own business and to invest in something where they have a special edge compared with the rest of the market, where they have an insider's knowledge. That's what I would do. Or give money to a portfolio manager. If you're very lucky, he will not lose your money, but you have to be very lucky. Chapter 6.11. Charles Schwab, Talking to Chuck, the People's Broker. founder and chairman of Charles Schwab Corporation. You've seen the ads. A handsome, white-haired man looks directly at you through the camera and urges you to own your tomorrow. Or maybe you remember the ones where cartoon people ask questions about their investments and a balloon pops up encouraging them to talk to Chuck. That's the style of personal engagement and openness that's kept Charles Schwab at the pinnacle of the discount brokerage industry for the past 40 years and has helped build a financial empire with $2.38 trillion of client assets under management, 9.3 million brokerage accounts, 1.4 million corporate retirement plan participants, 956,000 banking accounts, and a network serving 7,000 registered investment advisors. Before Chuck Schwab came along, if you wanted to buy some stocks, you had to go through a cartel of traditional brokers or brokerage firms that charged exorbitant fees for every trade. But in 1975, when the Securities and Exchange Commission forced the industry to deregulate, Schwab created one of the first discount brokerages and pioneered a whole new way of doing business that shook Wall Street to its core. He led an investor revolution where suddenly individuals could fully participate in the markets without costly middlemen. While clubby brokerages like Merrill Lynch raised their trading fees, Charles Schwab slashed or even eliminated his fees and offered an array of no-frills services that put the client's interests first and established the model for a new industry. Later, he led the charge into electronic trading and continues to pioneer innovations that educate and empower investors to make their own decisions. At age 76, Chuck Schwab comes across with tremendous humility and integrity. "People seem to have confidence in us," he told me. "We try to treat everyone with the sense that we are trustworthy and we need to take care of their assets in a very cautious way." It's possible that Chuck's modesty and quiet confidence come from a life spent overcoming a series of challenges, beginning with a struggle with dyslexia, a learning disability he shares with a surprising number of ultra-successful business leaders, from Richard Branson of the Virgin Group to John Chambers of Cisco Systems. Despite his reading difficulties, Chuck graduated from Stanford University and earned an MBA from Stanford Business School. He launched his career in finance in 1963 with an investment newsletter. Chuck embraced his status as a Wall Street outsider and planted his flag in his native California, establishing his brokerage firm in San Francisco in 1973. Since then, Charles Schwab Corporation has ridden the wild bull and bear markets of the past four decades, bouncing back from the crashes of 1987, 2001, and 2008 that wiped out lesser firms, taking on the slew of copycat companies that eroded its market share, always finding ways to innovate and grow in every environment. Although he turned over the reins as CEO in 2008, Chuck stays active in the company as its chairman and largest single shareholder. According to Forbes, Chuck Schwab has a personal fortune of $6.4 billion. With his wife and his daughter, Carrie Schwab Pomerantz, he's been incredibly involved in the family's private foundations, which support entrepreneurial organizations working in education, poverty prevention, human services, and health. He's also chairman of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Chuck Schwab and I both have crazy schedules, but we were finally able to meet in his San Francisco offices just as this book was about to go to press. Here are some excerpts from that conversation. Tony Robbins. "Everyone knows the name Charles Schwab. They know the institution. But most people don't really know your story. I wonder if you would just share a few highlights. I understand you started becoming interested in investing as early as 13. Charles Schwab. "That's right. When I was 13, it was right after World War II and the world wasn't too rich. My dad was a small-town lawyer in California's Sacramento Valley, and certainly our family wasn't rich. I thought I'd be better off in life if I had more money, so I had to figure out how to make money. I talked to my dad about it, and he encouraged me to read biographies of the famous people in America. And they all seemed to do something about investing. So I said, man, that's for me. So when I was 13, I started a chicken company, raised chickens and all that. And then I did a bunch of other little business kinds of things. So I knew a lot about business and started thinking about how businesses function and operate." Tony, "Was it your original vision? And what were your first real practical steps? Give me highlights, if you would, to give people a sense of your journey." Charles, "Well, I was quite lucky early in the journey. I started out as a financial analyst, and I had some ups and downs along the way. I was about 35, and I had a lot of experience before I really started the company in 1973. And as a result, I knew some of the handicaps of the financial business, including why they didn't treat people well enough. It was because they were really focused on making themselves money, but not on giving the investor a fair shake. They always thought about their institution and making money first. I said, aha, there's going to be a different way. Tony, what has been the competitive advantage at Charles Schwab over the years? I mean, if you look at the size of the North American investment market, I think it's about $32 trillion, and you guys have to represent a sizable amount. Charles, we're probably 5% to 10% of the retail market, something like that. But you know, as I got into business, I wanted to look at every product, every service that we offer clients through our clients' eyes. We would design a product like a no-load mutual fund. We did it in a big way. We made it free for people to buy no-load funds through us years ago. People would say, well, how are you going to make money at that? So we figured out a way to make some money at it. We worked with the mutual fund companies and convinced them to pay us a little fee out of their management fees, and our clients would benefit from it. And it flourished. So the individual got a great advantage by buying a plethora of no-load mutual funds for no fee. We did the same kind of analysis along the way for other things that we did. We looked at it first through the client's eyes. But Wall Street did just the reverse. They always made a decision. How much money can we make on this first? Okay, let's do it. Let's go sell it, boys. That's the way they made decisions. We were completely the opposite. Tony, has that shifted or is it still the same? Charles, it's still the same, and that's why it's a pretty interesting market for us. You know, we have a sort of unlimited destiny, I think, to continue to treat the client as the king and make sure we do everything that's in their interests first. Yes, we will make a little bit of money, which we do, of course. We're a profit-making organization, but first, we think about the client. Tony, what do you think are the two or three myths that you try to point out to them to pay attention to so they don't get sucked in when they think about investing? Charles, well, it's so easy. I've watched it in Wall Street so many times. You see the abuses that come about. Some really fancy broker comes along and says, ma'am, would you like to make some money? Of course, we all say yes, and then you get engaged in the conversation. These guys have the best widget you've ever seen in your life, and it's going to be just like another Apple. So we all naturally sort of listen to the story, then say, okay, I'll put some money into that. Well, the probability of that working out is about 1 in 10,000. It's like, why don't you just go out to the horses or buy a lottery ticket that day? That'll satisfy your speculative thing. Put the real money you have into an index fund where you know the outcome is going to be highly predictable and returns will be really quite good. Tony, so many people will get hurt because they don't know things and they don't ask questions. And you're one of the first people to say, ask questions. Charles, right. Tony, but very few people know the questions to ask. You know, they see a mutual fund and they see its return and they think that's the return they receive. And as you and I both know, that's just not true. Charles, it's just not true. It's never. Anything of the past is never promised for the future. But there are reasons why we put out a pamphlet, a white paper on index funds. We talk about the reasons why stocks are the greatest place, really, to have long-term investments. And the reason why is that companies are in business to grow. Every board I've ever been on, and I've done 6 or 7 different Fortune 500 boards, every conversation at the board meeting is about growth. How can we grow this company? If you don't grow, you fire the management. Get a new management team in. Now, that building over there is a beautiful building, but you come back 100 years from now, that building will still be the same size, or be knocked down. But it doesn't grow. Only companies grow. And that's why it's a fantastic thing to go into stocks. And of course, in our case, we try to encourage people to go into index funds, so they get a broad blend of industries and stocks and so forth. Then they have, Tony, the lowest costs, Charles, the lowest costs, and they get a high degree of certainty that they're going to do as well as the index will do. And if you look at any industries over the last 100 years, they've done extraordinarily well over time and great returns to clients. Tony, if you listen to Vanguard's Jack Bogle or somebody like David Swensen from Yale, they all say passive management is the way to go, because 96% of all mutual funds do not match the index over a 10-year period of time. But how do you feel about it for the average investor, passive versus active? Charles, well, I'm a mixed investor. I invest in a lot of individual stocks. But I have the time, I have the expertise, I have the education. But 98% of people don't focus on that. They have other things in life to do rather than fuss around investments as I've done or Warren Buffett has. You know, they are professionals and they're doctors or lawyers, they're whatever. We need all those people to make a successful society, and maybe 2% of us really know about investing. So the rest of the people need some help and advice. That's what I learned early on, and that's what we do today. And the 98% should really predominantly go into index funds, in my view. They have the most predictable outcomes, better than they would ever have by trying to pick different things, which is very difficult to do, and then do their job, too. You can't do both. Tony, the other part is people just don't realize what cost is, and Jack Bogle points out for every 1% over the lifetime of investing, it's 20% of your money you're giving up. Charles, yeah, it's over. Tony, give up 2%, that's 40%. Give up 3%, that's 60%. Charles, that's a whole lot, and on an after-tax basis, it really mounts up. Tony, every major investor that I spoke to talks of the fact that asset allocation is the single most important investment decision a person can make. You deal with so many different types of investors. What philosophy do you try to have your team apply to help people understand what their asset allocation should be? Charles, well, it's actually pretty easy today. It wasn't that true 40 years ago. Now we have index funds that we mentioned and ETFs. You can get different slices of the market so you can have plenty of diversification. You want energy stocks? You can get an energy ETF. You want medical devices? You can do that. And of course, I tend to believe you should be diversified among the very biggest and 10 biggest industry groupings. And that's what you generally get in a general index fund. You get all of them because you never know. Sometimes electronic equipment will be going, zooming right up. Oil might be not doing so well, but next year, oil is in demand, so oil prices are going up, and that does well, and so on and so forth. But it allows you to get the balance of the benefits of each of these sectors. Tony, how do you feel about investing in America versus international when you're trying to create that asset allocation? Charles, that's another level of sophistication which I think everybody should have in their portfolio. Some chunk devoted to international. Because the very simple fact is, America is growing at about 2 to 3% per annum now. There are many other countries that are beginning to, from China to Indonesia to Japan, have better growth than America. So that's where you're going to get your better returns, where there is better growth, frankly. But even though the American economy is only growing 2%, there are some parts of our economy that are really growing quite fast. So obviously you want to be attracted to them, too. Tony, where do you see the world going in the next 10 years? What do you think those opportunities and challenges are for investors? Charles, I think there are enormous opportunities ahead of us still, despite how slow things are going right now. It will explode once we get the kind of policies I think we'll eventually get bank in. Because there's no way you're going to take the growth component out of America. The innovation going on in this country is profound. I mean, I live in the San Francisco area where it's just going busting at the seams wherever you walk. It's there. Tony, are we in a market bubble with the Fed controlling rates the way they are, where you would have to take significant risk to see rewards? The market seems to be the only place for money to go. How long does that last? Charles, well, I'm not a great fan of the present policy of the Federal Reserve. I think manipulating rates as long as they have is really not the right decision. And I guess it does create the potential and the possibility of some kind of bubble. It won't be forever. We will probably pay a price for it, but it's not a permanent issue. And so there'll be some high inflation or down markets. There will be a consequence for what we're doing now. But we'll get through it, as we do every time there's bad decisions made by policymakers. Tony, they all have a different language for it, but for every single major investor in the world, one of their competitive advantages is asymmetric risk slash reward. They take a little risk to try to get a big reward. How does the average investor do that today? Is there any insight you can give to them? Charles, well, I think it's all coming back to the answer. Where can you get the best growth? Understanding the fundamentals of growth is crucially important to get long-term returns. Now, in the case of Warren Buffett, he learned that at a young age. He just buys companies and he never sells. Why? Companies keep growing. They just keep growing, and he gets richer and richer. Tony, he doesn't pay taxes. Charles, and he doesn't pay taxes. If you don't sell, you don't pay taxes. Tony, that's pretty awesome. Charles, that's his mystery. The myth has been solved. He doesn't sell. Tony, I believe you have 5 children? Charles, and 12 grandkids. Tony, 12 grandkids. Tell me, if you could leave none of your money to your children, but you could only leave a set of investment principles and maybe a portfolio, what would be your advice to them? Charles, well, I think it really starts with earning your own money, having success in that, and the concept of putting some money aside. Make sure you get the right education, and hopefully it fits into the marketplace where jobs are being created. You've got to have a well-paying job, which are not that plentiful today. And then putting the money aside in your 401k or IRA. It takes giving up things, not buying that car, giving up that vacation, having something set aside. And then you could begin doing the proper investing. It's a pretty simple formula. Lots of people don't realize it, but hopefully you can teach people to do that. Tony, hopefully I can. Charles, you know, I believe in leaving something, making sure the kids are educated, but not sizable sums of money. Don't take away their sense of their own opportunity, their own ego development, their own kinds of things that will fulfill them. You have to be a really curious person. Make sure every one of your kids is really curious, and it's not necessarily about making money. Having come from a background of no money and no wealth, I clearly know the difference, and of course in the last 20 years I've had the benefit of success, which allows me incredible choices. For my wife and I, we take a vacation without worrying about the cost of it, having a good time. I enjoy my sports, I love my golf, and it goes on and on and on. And so we want to perpetuate this success. We want our next generations to have what we had, and then some. Tony, you've dealt with so many successful people. You've studied successful companies and the individuals who drive their growth. What do you think is the single most important factor? Charles, you know, maybe it's 99% necessity, but lots of people out there in the world really do need more resources, but they don't have the education. Somehow, they didn't have the motivation. Maybe they don't sense opportunity in front of them. How to perceive the opportunity that is right there. You look around at these other guys who have been successful and you think, I can do that too. How do you sense that? I don't know. Tony, you're 76 now and you didn't find out you were dyslexic until you were in your 40s, right? Charles, right. Tony, a lot of people think of that as the limit on their life. How come it was never a limit to you? Charles, maybe, thank God, that I didn't know when I was a kid. But my son was just starting school when we took him for testing and found out he was dyslexic. I said, oh my God, all the things that I had to deal with at age 7, 8, and 9, he's dealing with now. And it was very clear that I was also dyslexic, so that solved a lot of my issues when I thought back about my early schooling. The alphabet was impossible for me. My reading, even to this day, I don't read novels. I read nothing but nonfiction. Tony, wow, so what allowed you to succeed in the financial business then? Charles, well, I was pretty good at math, and I was pretty good with people. I wasn't a great writer, but I had people around me who were great writers. So you learn very quickly, you can't do it all yourself. You need to have people around you who are better than you are at most other things. But you have to be able to inspire the people around you to work together for whatever our common purpose was. And that's what I've been able to do all these years. Tony, what's your passion? Charles, I'm totally passionate about the necessity for people to earn and save and grow because of the responsibility we all have for our own retirements. And goodness gracious, we're going to live, you know. I'm in my 70s, but the probability now is living to 90, 95. It's a long time to be in retirement. And so you've got to put aside a lot of assets, I think, in order to live comfortably. Tony, people I talk to who knew you 20 years ago say your passion is as great or greater than it ever was. Charles, probably greater. Tony, wow, why is that? How have you maintained that? How has that continued to expand? Charles, well, I have seen, for instance, what you can do with philanthropy, and how you can really help people by being successful. Well, I couldn't do it if I was not successful, I wouldn't have the resources to do it with. But I can make things happen in different ways. Whether it's issues around dyslexia, I can help kids, or in charter schools, we can help kids. Or if it's in museums, help build bigger and better places for people to come and see and view. I think it's one of the great fulfillments of achieving great success, being able to, in your own lifetime, give back to things that it really enhances many, many times, you know, that people can really enjoy, and yourself. Tony, if someone was starting out brand new, what would be the advantage you would try to give them looking to start a business? How do you go from the vision of a young man that you were, who said, I want to really help people look out for the customer, to building a multi-trillion dollar business? What would you tell people they should really focus on? Charles, well, getting all the education and the practical experience, and then having the patience to do it day in and day out. Day in and day out. It's not easy, let me tell you that. It's like the restaurateur, serving great food every meal. It's not easy, but that's how you make a great restaurant. That's how you make a great car dealership. Service every day. You can't miss the ball. You've got to hit the ball out of the park every day with service. And the same with technology. In our lifetime, we've seen many companies go in the tank because they weren't able to innovate. Or actually, they didn't figure out a product or service that really served the customer well. They lost their customers. Never lose a customer. Figure that one out. Tony, last question. I'm sure it will be 20 or 30 years from now because you're taking care of yourself and your health, and you're so passionate. But how do you want to be remembered? What's your legacy for you and what you've built over this lifetime? Charles, well, I have a variety of them, of course, for my family and so forth. In terms of the professional side, I feel really proud about the fact that I really made a huge change to the practice of Wall Street. This is an institution that's been around for a couple hundred years, and we, this little company on the West Coast, took them on in different ways, and really made a change in the character of how they treat clients. And they're doing a much better job. Not as good as we are, but they're doing a much better job, and are much more thoughtful about how they treat their clients. Tony, you led by example. Charles, thanks very much. Tony, blessings to you, and thank you for your time. Chapter 6.12, Sir John Templeton, the greatest investor of the 20th century. Founder of Templeton Mutual Funds, philanthropist, creator of the £1 million Templeton Prize. Sir John Templeton wasn't just one of the greatest money masters of all time. He was one of the great human beings who ever lived, and I had the honor of counting him as one of my mentors. His motto, how little we know, how eager to learn, guided his long and dazzling life as an investment pioneer, iconoclast, spiritual seeker, and philanthropist. Sir John was known for his ability to look at the most difficult situations in the world and find a way to take advantage of them for the greater good. John Templeton was not always known as Sir John. He came from humble beginnings in a small town in Tennessee, where he was reared to value thrift, self-sufficiency, and personal discipline. He worked his way through Yale and Oxford and got his first job on Wall Street in 1937 in the depths of the Great Depression. He was the original contrarian who believed in buying shares at the point of maximum pessimism. When everyone else thought the world was going to end, John thought it was the right time to invest. When everyone else thought, oh my God, these are the greatest times in history, that was when it was time to sell. He first put his theory to the test in the fall of 1939. With the Depression still raging and Hitler's troops rolling into Poland at the start of World War II, John Templeton decided to take all the money he had saved and borrow some additional money as well, and buy $100 worth of every stock valued at less than $1 on the New York Stock Exchanges. That portfolio became the basis of a vast personal fortune and asset management empire. He also became a pioneer in international investing. While the rest of Americans refused to look beyond U.S. borders, John was scouring the world for opportunities. And as his fortune grew, so did his commitment to giving back. In 1972, he established the world's largest annual award given to an individual, bigger than the Nobel Prize, honoring spiritual achievements. Mother Teresa was the first recipient of the Templeton Prize. His foundation also funded research in science and technology, and in 1987, Queen Elizabeth knighted him for his enormous contributions to humanity. Sir John continued to speak and write and inspire millions with his humble message of integrity, entrepreneurship, and faith, right up to the time of his death in 2008, at the age of 95. Incidentally, he had accurately predicted the collapse of the housing bubble that year. The following is an excerpt from an interview I conducted with him just months before his passing. His kindness shines through in every answer as he shares his philosophy that the same qualities that make you a great investor can also make you a great human being. Tony Robbins. Sir John, most people seem to be either money-oriented or spiritually-oriented. They have to be one or the other. But you seem to have found a way to integrate these two in a truly natural and real way in your life. Can people integrate both in their lives? John Templeton. Definitely, there is no disparity. Would you want to deal with a businessman you could not trust? No. If a man has a reputation for not being trustworthy, people will run away from him. His business will fail. But if another man has high ethical principles, high spiritual principles, he will try to give to his customers and his employees more than they expect. If so, he will be popular. He will have more customers. He will make more profit. He will do more good in the world, and thereby he will prosper himself and have more friends and be more respected. So always start out to give more than is expected from you, to treat the other person more than fairly, and that is the secret of success. Never try to take advantage of anyone or to hold anyone back in their own progress. The more you help others, the more prosperous you will be personally. Tony, what was your first investment? What drew you to it and how did it turn out? John, I was just getting started when it was the beginning of the Second World War in September 1939. We had just finished the world's greatest depression, and there were many bankrupt companies. But a war causes a demand for almost every product, so during a war, almost every company will prosper again. So I gave a stockbroker an order to buy $100 worth of every stock on both exchanges, selling for $1 or less, and there were 104 of them. And out of those, I made a profit on 100 and lost money on only 4. So 3 years later, when my wife and I had an opportunity to take over this small practice of a retiring investment counselor, we had the savings needed to do that. We began with no clients in Radio City in New York and worked there for 25 years, continuing to save 50 cents out of every dollar so that we could build up our assets for our retirement and for charity. Tony, wow, and you got quite a bit of return saving 50 cents out of every dollar, Sir John. Most people today would say that's impossible. I can't save 50% of my money and invest it. But that's how you built from nothing, and how you did this during the Depression. I've also read that if someone invested $100,000 with you in 1940, never put another dime in, forgot about the money, by 1999 that would be worth $55 million. Is that the accurate number? John, yes, provided they reinvested their distributions. Tony, let me ask you about your investing philosophy. In the past, you've said to me not only do you buy at maximum pessimism, but you want to sell at the peak of optimism. Is that correct? John, that's correct. There's a good saying there, Tony. Bear markets start on the time of pessimism. They rise on the time of skepticism. They mature on the time of optimism, and they end on the time of euphoria. That always happens in every bull market, and it helps you determine where you are. If you will just talk with enough investors to find their psychology, you can tell whether the market is still safe at a low level or high at a dangerous level. Tony, what do you think is the single biggest mistake investors make? John, the great majority of people do not build up any wealth because they do not practice the self-discipline of saving some of their income every month. But beyond that, once you've saved that money, then you have to invest it wisely in good bargains, and it's not easy. It's very rare for any one person, particularly any one person working in just their spare time, to select the right investments. Any more than you would want to be your own medical doctor or your own lawyer, it's not wise to try to be your own investment manager. It's better to find the best professionals, the wisest security analysts to help you. Tony, when I was talking to some of your associates down in the Bahamas, I was asking them, what does he invest in? And they said, anything. He'll buy a tree if he thinks he can get a good deal on it. Then I said, how long will he hang on to it? And they said, forever, basically until it's worth more. Sir John, how long do you hang on to an investment before you know to let it go? How do you know if you've made a mistake? how do you know when it's time to actually liquidate? John, that is one of the most important questions. Many people will say, I know when to buy, but I don't know when to sell. But over these 54 years that I've been helping investors, I think I have the answer. And that is you sell an asset only when you think you have found a different asset that's a 50% better bargain. You search all the time for a bargain, and then you look at what you now own. If there's something in your present list that is 50% less good bargain than the one you found, you sell the old one and buy the new one. But even then, you're not right all the time. Tony, Sir John, why should Americans feel good about investing outside their own country? John, think about this. If your job is to find the best opportunities, surely we will find more opportunities if we do not limit ourselves to just any one nation. Likewise, perhaps we will find better opportunities if we are able to look everywhere rather than just one nation. But most important is, it does reduce your risk because every nation has bear markets. Usually twice every 12 years there's a severe bear market in a major nation, but they do not occur at the same time. So if you are diversified, having your assets in many nations, you do not have to suffer through the bear market in one nation as a person who had all of his eggs in one basket. We have always advised our investors to be diversified, not only diversified into more than one corporation and diversified into more than one industry, but also diversified into more than one nation in order that they will get greater safety and greater potential profit. Tony, what do you think it is that has separated you from all the other investors out there? What's made you one of the greatest investors of all time? John, thank you. I do not regard myself as that. We've not always been right. No one is. But we have tried to be a little better than the other competitors and to give more than is expected from us and always try to improve our methods, to use new methods in order to stay ahead of the competition. If there's any secret in it all, it is this. Do not try to be a go-getter. Try to be a go-giver. Tony, Sir John, there's so much fear out there today in so many levels of society. How do we deal with fear? John, to overcome fear, the best thing is to be overwhelmingly grateful. If you wake up each morning and think of 5 new things for which you're overwhelmingly grateful, you're not likely to be fearful. You're likely to radiate your optimism, your attitude of gratitude. You're likely to do things in a better way, draw more people to you. So I would think an attitude of gratitude will prevent a life of fear. Tony, I would love to hear, through your own perception, who is Sir John Templeton? What is your life really about? In the end, how do you want to be remembered? John, I am a student, always trying to learn. I am a sinner. All of us are. I've tried to be better day by day, and particularly, I try to keep asking myself, what are the purposes of God? Why did God create the universe? What does God expect of his children here? And the closest you can come in just a few words is, he expects us to grow spiritually. He gives us trials and tribulations just like you have examinations in school, because it may help you grow into a greater soul than you would have otherwise. So life is a challenge. Life is an adventure. It's a marvelous, exciting adventure. All of us should do the very best we can as long as the Lord allows us to be on this planet. Section 7. Just do it, enjoy it, and share it. Chapter 7.1. The future is brighter than you think. The point of living is to believe the best is yet to come. Peter Ustinov. Why do most people pursue wealth? It's because they're after a greater quality of life. And one thing I know beyond a shadow of a doubt is that anybody can deal with a tough today if he or she feels certain that tomorrow has greater promise. We all need a compelling future. So if you're wondering why we would take time to talk about the future and technological breakthroughs in a financial book, it's because technology is a hidden asset that every day is compounding its capacity to enrich your life. There are breakthroughs occurring today and in the months and short years to come that will revolutionize the quality of your life and the lives of everyone else on Earth. This tide of technology will offer the opportunity for all boats to rise. And in financial terms, you know what's really great? The cost of technology is decreasing while its capacity is geometrically expanding. What does that mean for you? It means that even if you start building wealth late in life, you will likely still have a great quality of life in the future for even less money than you might think. Also, learning about these trends and technologies can awaken you to some of the greatest investment opportunities of your lifetime. These technologies are growing exponentially. The time to pay attention to them is right now. My hope is that this chapter will also inspire you to take greater care of yourself and your family, not only financially, but perhaps physically as well. Without physical health, there is no wealth. Being around long enough to take advantage of some of these huge advances in technology should be a priority, especially after you hear about some of the changes that are unfolding as we speak. So let's take a brief journey together and explore the cutting edge of our technological future. I'll say in advance, this chapter takes an unabashedly positive view. But it's not just based on my enthusiasm, but rather reflects the work of some of the greatest scientists on the face of the earth. Not those who just predict, but those who deliver what they predict. Individuals who have done everything from decode the human genome to design the first digital voice recognition system to develop commercial space shuttles that fly people back and forth to the International Space Station. Now, I acknowledge that many people have a different, more skeptical view of technology, and perhaps they'll be right. Some look into the future and see a Terminator-style dystopia of killer robots and genetically altered Frankenfoods. Others look forward to a world of flying cars like they had in the Jetsons, or android helpers like Star Wars C-3PO, or meat and vegetables that can be grown from single cells to feed the world's hungry. None of these extreme scenarios has come to pass yet. I choose to look at how technology will be used to make a massive difference in the quality of our lives. I also understand that people often fear new technologies and worry that we're going too fast. After all, there's always been a dark side to these advances, often because these technologies initially put people out of jobs until they adapt to new forms of employment. As Stephen Ratner, the influential financier and columnist, pointed out in the New York Times, even Queen Elizabeth I of England refused to patent a 16th century knitting machine because it would put her poor subjects out of work. But according to Ratner, the trick is not to protect old jobs, but to create new ones. And since the invention of the wheel, that's what has occurred. Most of the time, these new tools have been used to enhance human life. And today, some of the biggest challenges in the world, from too much carbon dioxide in the air, to a lack of fresh water, to a scarcity of farmland, are being solved by new technologies. And all this seems to be happening overnight. But throughout history, there has also been a minority who will take any tool or technology and use it as a weapon. A Boeing jetliner can carry us across oceans or be used as a bomb to murder thousands. But there are millions more flights than hijackings. It's natural for human beings to fear the new and unknown and to focus on worst-case scenarios. Our brains are wired for survival, and that's how we've made it as a species. But our imaginations can also hold us back. Science fiction has made many fear futuristic technologies, like artificial intelligence. But actual scientists and futurists such as Ray Kurzweil, Peter Diamandis, and Juan Enriquez see advanced technologies as an opportunity for humanity to evolve and transform into something better. So if you're irritated by an optimistic future, you should move on to the next chapter. But if you're a person who is truly interested in knowing how technology is shaping our lives, I think this will help you understand what's available and what's coming. The way I look at it, you can choose to be fearful about the future, or you can embrace it. But nothing is going to change it. Why? Because the future is already here. The best way to predict the future is to invent it. Alan Kay. Every 10 minutes in America, someone is horribly burned. They're rushed to the hospital in searing pain, one of the most intense pains a human body can suffer. The nurses scrub away the blistered and charred flesh and cover the wound with cadaver skin to keep the person from dying of infection. Can you imagine the skin off a dead body put on top of your own? If the patient survives, the scarring can be brutal. I'm sure you've seen faces, arms, and legs scarred beyond recognition. Sometimes there are multiple surgeries, and healing can take years. So imagine how one night Matt Urim, a 40-year-old state trooper, finds himself about to become another one of those grim statistics. His life altered forever. How? He's next to a bonfire when someone throws a cup of gasoline on the flames and the burns cover his right arm and the right side of his head and face. The doctors and nurses move fast, cleaning off the blistered skin, disinfecting Matt's wounds, applying salves. Normally, he would be in the burn unit for weeks or months, going through the same agonizing process twice a day. Instead, a team of specialists goes to work with a new technique. They harvest a layer of healthy cells from unburned patches of his own skin. No cadaver skin for Matt. These cells are cultured, and before long, a spray gun is gently painting the wounds with a solution of Matt's own stem cells. 3 days later, his arms and face are completely healed, and this miracle has to be seen to be believed. Do an internet search for the skin gun on YouTube and see the difference. There's barely a scar visible on him. I know it sounds like a scene from a sci-fi film, but it's a real story that took place in Pittsburgh just a few years ago. While the technique that healed Matt Urim is still in clinical trials in the U.S., a similar stem cell procedure has already been used on hundreds of burn victims in Europe and Australia. Amazing, isn't it? Now there's even a biopen that allows surgeons to draw healthy cells on layers of bone and cartilage. The cells multiply and grow into nerves, muscle, and bones, healing the damaged section. The technology allows the surgeon to place cells wherever he or she wants them in an instant. And this is just another one of the incredible new therapies coming online and becoming more affordable for everyone. If you hadn't already noticed, the world we live in today is a place of everyday miracles, and change is happening so fast that sometimes we don't even notice it. Or maybe we just take it for granted. But if you were to describe the world of 2015 to a person back in 1980, just 35 years ago, they would think what you're doing is magic. Spraying on stem cells? Hell, it would be a miracle just to talk to someone on a phone while you were driving in your car, right? We're used to the idea that we can predict tomorrow by looking at what happened today or yesterday. But that can't be done anymore. Until very recently, change was very rare and so slow that it was measured in eras, the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, and so on. Now change is exponential. That means it's speeding up, making huge leaps forward in shorter periods of time. It means we're making tools that can transform the quality of our lives faster and better, and they're available to just about everyone. The average person today already has options the richest pharaoh in Egypt never dreamed of. Imagine what he would have given to be able to fly in the sky in a chair or in a bed to another part of the world in a few hours instead of months fighting the oceans. Now you can do that for $494 on Virgin Airways. Even a pharaoh couldn't spend $200 million to make a movie to entertain himself for 2 hours. And yet every week, multiple new films are coming out that we can enjoy in the theater for $10, or $9.99 per month on Netflix. Let's face it, we're living in one of the most extraordinary times on Earth. We've seen the lifespan of human beings in the last 100 years go from 31 years old to 67 years old, more than doubling. In the same time, the average per capita income, adjusted for inflation, of every person on this planet tripled. 100 years ago, the majority of Americans used to spend 43% of each day working just to get food. Now, because of advances in agriculture and distribution, it's 7%. You've got mail. The first time I met President Bill Clinton back in the early 1990s, I vividly remember sitting down with him and saying, "You know, Mr. President, maybe there's a way we could communicate electronically." He looked puzzled, so I said, "I've started using this new thing called email. I've got an account on AOL. Do you have one?" And the president said, "Oh, I've heard about that." But there was no email account for the President of the United States back then. Now the phone that an Amazonian tribesman carries around the jungle has more instant computing power than Clinton had at his disposal as leader of the free world. He can go online to buy supplies for his cows or pay his child's school fees. He can translate languages. If he wants, he can access free courses in economics from Yale and math from MIT. We're living in a whole different universe now, and we're just at the beginning of the beginning. And things are getting better, faster, every day. The future is going to be a whole lot better than you think, says my dear friend Peter Diamandis, founder of the XPRIZE Foundation, aerospace engineer, medical doctor, entrepreneur, and all-round great human being. Humanity is now entering a period of radical transformation in which technology has the potential to significantly raise the basic standards of living for every man, woman, and child on the planet. But what does this mean for you? It means that even if you screw up and you don't follow through on anything you've learned in this book, in the future you'll still be able to enjoy a better quality of life than you ever imagined, even if you don't have a large income. And for those who do, the possibilities are limitless. The key to abundance is meeting limited circumstances with unlimited thoughts. Marianne Williamson. Technology is going to change what we think of as scarcity. It's the common denominator that makes us fearful. The idea that there won't be enough of what we need and what we value. Water, food, money, resources, time, space, joy, and love. Why do people want to be wealthy? They believe if they are, they'll always have enough, that they'll never have to go without. It's a fear that's hardwired into our brains. But scarcity doesn't have to be a permanent condition. Technology can change it. Did you know that there was a time when the rarest, most precious metal on Earth was aluminum? That's right. Separating the element from clay used to be incredibly difficult and expensive. Aluminum was the ultimate status symbol in 19th century France. At an imperial banquet, Napoleon III served the King of Siam with aluminum utensils instead of the usual gold. But by the end of the century, scientists figured out how to process aluminum on a mass scale, and the light, inexpensive metal suddenly flooded the market. Peter Diamandis likes to use the story of aluminum to point out that scarcity is a function of our ability, or lack of ability, to access resources. He wrote an extraordinary book, Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think, which covers in 300 or so pages the concepts that this chapter is trying to capture in just a few. Here's a great metaphor from the book about how technology can overcome scarcity. Imagine a giant orange tree packed with fruit, Peter writes. If I pluck all of the oranges from the lower branches, I am effectively out of accessible fruit. Oranges are now scarce. But once someone invents a piece of technology called a ladder, I've suddenly got new reach. Problem solved. Technology is a resource-liberating mechanism. Given the way our world population is growing, we'll need to be liberating those resources faster than ever. That exponential change we were talking about? Here's an example. It took a little more than 200,000 years, or until the year 1804, for the population of human beings to multiply to a total of 1 billion people. It took only 123 years, 1927, for the human population to double to 2 billion people. But it took just 33 years, 1960, before there were 3 billion people on the planet. It took a mere 14 years, 1974, for another billion to be added for a total of 4 billion people. This growth has not stopped. In spite of China's one-child-per-family policy for its 1.3 billion population, and all the other efforts to stop world population growth, in the last 40 years alone, we've added more than 3 billion more people. That's 300% more people in these last three decades than it originally took 200,000 years to achieve. Today, there are 7.2 billion people on the planet. If we keep going at our current pace of growth, scientists estimate the population will be 9.6 billion by 2050. How can the Earth sustain so many people? If we keep consuming our natural resources at the current rate, according to Jim Leap of the Worldwide Fund for Nature International, as quoted in the Wall Street Journal, we are using 50% more resources than the Earth can sustainably produce, and unless we change course, that number will grow fast. By 2030, even two planets will not be enough. human ingenuity and technology together have a way of keeping up with our needs. I remember a time when we thought we were running out of oil. In the early 1970s, when I was a junior in high school, there was an oil crisis in the Middle East. If you recall, gas was rationed on odd or even days. I was wondering if we'd run out of fuel before I even got my license. Then, one day in school, my engineering teacher said, "Let me read you an article." I'd already seen the Time magazine with a report from the Club of Rome scaring the daylights out of everybody with predictions that our oil supply would last only a few more years and the whole economy would collapse. This article sounded just like that, using the same language of gloom and doom. Then he showed us what he'd been reading, a newspaper article from the 1850s about an oil crisis, and the oil they were talking about was whale oil. In the 19th century, whale blubber was the main source of lamp oil. You couldn't light your home without it. But whales were being overfished, people were worried about shortages of oil, and prices were going through the roof. But what happened in 1859? Crude oil was discovered in Pennsylvania. A whole new source became available. Before long, we had kerosene lamps, and then internal combustion engines. The oil crisis of 1973? Technology had already eased that scarcity. New exploration and extraction techniques were opening up vast quantities of fossil fuels. And now, with sideways drilling technologies, we have more gas than Saudi Arabia has oil. Such technologies change not only an economy, but can also have an impact on geopolitical power. For the first time in almost a decade, in 2013, the United States produced more domestic oil than it imported from the Middle East. The future is an alternative, such as wind power, biofuels, and the Grand Slam winner, solar energy. According to the inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil, all of the world's energy needs can be met with 1/10,000th of the sunlight that falls on the Earth each day. The challenge has been to capture and store that power for a competitive cost. Ray predicts that the cost per watt of solar energy will be less than oil and coal in just a few years. What we need is more people who specialize in the impossible. Theodore Retke. Let's pause for a moment and think. Where will all this new technology come from? It's already been bubbling out of the usual places. Silicon Valley, NASA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, and the world's great universities and laboratories. But more and more, do-it-yourself inventors are using the vast resources of the Internet to find ways to do things faster and better and cheaper. Let me tell you about a teenager I met who is revolutionizing the world of prosthetics from a lab in his bedroom. Easton LaChapelle was running a robotics program for NASA when he was 17, and he didn't have to go to a major university to learn engineering. He had the Internet. Easton grew up in a tiny town in southwestern Colorado, where there wasn't much for a kid to do. So he entertained himself by tearing up and reassembling household gadgets. When he was 14, he decided to build his own robotic hand. Hey, why not? There was no big library in town, no university nearby, so he scoured websites like Instructables and Hackett to teach himself electronics, programming, and mechanics. Then he used objects he had lying around, Legos, fishing line, electrical tape, small hobby motors, and a Nintendo Power Glove, to build a prototype. By the time he was 16, he had refined his design by getting access to a 3D printer and creating a mechanical hand out of layers of plastic. He entered his invention in the state science fair, and it was there that Easton had what he calls his aha moment. He met a 7-year-old girl with a prosthetic arm that cost her parents $80,000. She would need two more over her lifetime. Easton thought, who can afford that? Besides, the mechanical hand attached to the arm had only one sensor and one motion. His device was much more sophisticated, with 5 flexible fingers. Then and there, he decided to create a simple, functional, and affordable prosthetic to help amputees like this little girl. Easton went back to his bedroom lab and built a full robotic limb that replicated the motion and strength of a human arm. Even more amazing, he came up with an EEG headset that converts electronic brainwaves into Bluetooth signals that controls it. Yes, these things don't just exist in sci-fi movies. The arm weighs one-third less than the $80,000 version, and it's much stronger. In fact, a person using this arm can curl more than 300 pounds. A giant improvement on the past technology.